Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A jobs report that's kind of a head-scratcher. The joys of being a geek. And hey, buddy, have you seen my bulldozer? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, the 7th of January. Good, as always, to have you here. And I don't know how to set up the unemployment story you're about to hear other than to say we just got a weird jobs report this morning, not even close to what we were expecting. First, according to the monthly survey of households, the unemployment rate fell last month from 9.8 to 9.4%. That's the kind of roller coaster drop that gives economists vertigo, and it puts the unemployment rate at the lowest it's been in a year and a half. But, and with a setup like that, you kind of knew the but was coming. The survey of employers showed just 103,000 new jobs in this economy in December. That is far less than anticipated, and it suggests employers are still reluctant at best to add new workers. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to explain what gives.
First, that drop in the unemployment rate. No one expected it. No one's complaining.
You know, I think it's a great thing that the unemployment rate went down to 9.4%.
That's Christine Owens of the National Employment Law Project. And while she is encouraged, she's still got a long list of worries about the job market.
The fact that we have had such high, persistent long-term unemployment for so long now, and that the numbers of discouraged workers are growing, and that we had close to 300,000 people drop out of the labor force.
In fact, about half that drop in the unemployment rate, it came from people giving up the job hunt altogether and not being counted as unemployed anymore. And this nearly jobless recovery hits some much harder than others, says John Canale of brokerage firm LPL Financial.
So the unemployment rate for those with less than a high school diploma is 15.3%. The unemployment rate for those with a bachelor's degree and higher is about 4.8%. So the gap between those two is key.
And likely to widen, says Christine Owens. It's worst for workers who found a seemingly bottomless pool of low-skilled jobs in retail, construction, or manufacturing before the recession.
Workers in those sectors that have really been hit hard by this downturn anyway, many of them are somewhat older. That doesn't mean they're old, but they're just somewhat older, and it's just harder to get back into the labor force.
Eventually, many economists predict they will be looking for work, which could send the unemployment rate up again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As long as we're on jobs, Ben Bernanke was up on Capitol Hill testifying today where he offered this prediction about the labor market and the new normal.
At this rate of improvement, it could take 4 to 5 more years for the job market to normalize fully.
He did say, though, that the economy is self-sustaining, so that's a net positive. With new Chief of Staff Bill Daley bringing a corporate perspective to the Obama administration, the White House is going to extend another olive branch to big business next Friday. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is scheduled to meet with a group of executives about corporate tax reform. The tax rate for businesses in this country tops out at 35%. That's the second highest rate among developed countries, just below Japan. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Corporations have wanted the government to overhaul the tax code for a long time. Clint Stretch is with Deloitte. He says this is an important conversation and a difficult one.
Everybody can agree, yes, I'd like a lower tax rate, but when you get down to what am I going to give up to get it, people may have very different views on that.
Right now, many U.S. companies get big breaks because the tax rate is so high.
It is essential that some means be in place to mitigate the damage done by our current systems.
Matt Dolan is a tax attorney with the Federal Policy Group. He says there's a deduction for manufacturing and production, a credit for research and design. He suspects a lower rate would help the economy because companies would expect more money after taxes.
And if prospective reward is greater, then there will be a greater willingness in turn to take more risk and to invest more capital.
Many countries have decided to lower their tax rates, including Canada, the UK, and Japan. The President's Deficit Commission recommended an overhaul. Matt Dolan says the Obama administration is taking a positive step, meeting with corporate executives.
I do think it will be helpful to building the relationships, but the consequence of those strengthened relationships won't be evident until proposals are made.
Experts say tax reform needs presidential support to succeed. Ronald Reagan led the last big overhaul in 1986. This time around, it seems the Obama administration is behind it. The Treasury Department says this will be the first of several meetings. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Commodities have been on an upward tear the past couple of months. Oil, gold, food and grain prices are all higher, as is cotton. Prices there have doubled over the past year, which is creating a big opportunity for cheaper synthetic fabrics, like, say, the cloth behind the Hawaiian shirt boom of the 1980s. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has more now on the revival of rayon.
Clothing makers and designers like BCBG, L.L. Bean, and Isaac Mizrahi have all started adding more rayon to their lines. Bert Flickinger is with consumer consulting firm Strategic Resource Group.
Rayon's making its way into mid-level fashion because it provides affordable fabric.
Cotton prices have been spiking because of damaged crops and growing demand worldwide. Stephen Cherkover is a stock analyst with D.A. Davidson. He says rayon's better known as a fabric of the 70s and 80s.
I think of Magnum P.I.
You know, Tom Selleck, his fabulous mustache, those loosely buttoned Hawaiian shirts. But Cherkover says rayon's not just a retro thing.
There are benefits that cotton doesn't have. So I think it's being blended into, you know, today's apparel.
Benefits like rayon dries fast and is much cheaper than cotton. Rayon is, by the way, made out of wood pulp, and its growing popularity is boosting business for some wood products companies that were hit by the housing crisis.
It's a windfall for some of the companies whose pulp mills were on the bubble.
But rayon's price has been climbing, too. Again, Bert Flickinger.
Even with the rayon substitutes, clothes inflation will be 15% during 2011.
That is, until the sales kick in. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
I used to have a great Hawaiian shirt. I think my wife threw it away. Anyway, there was a lot of selling on Wall Street today till about lunchtime, and then the buying kicked in. Not quite enough, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Friday, the first Friday of the new year and the end of a busy week. New Congress, new jobs numbers today. But is any of that going to change anything? Joining us now for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, which this week means Washington, D.C., is Heidi Moore from the New York Times Deal Book and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Heidi, Sudeep, good to have you both back.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So, Sudeep, obviously we're going to start in Washington. Big week down there. Lots of discussion about the deficit and regulations and new Congress. Here's my question, and I ask it only slightly tongue-in-cheek. When are people in government going to start getting serious about things like the deficits and the national debt and how this country raises and spends its money?
They will get serious about it when they can stop having fun with the debate about it. If this were a TV drama, it would last an hour and have no real consequences except poor ratings. And what we have now is something that actually has very real consequences as they put off these decisions and have what are basically political theater moments about the deficit and about the debt. We get into this zone where financial markets start noticing and actually taking what happens in Washington a little bit more seriously.
Which is the perfect segue to New York City and Ms. Heidi Moore and that concept of the financial markets really starting to take notice. Heidi, when's that going to happen?
The financial markets are just kind of going their own way. A lot of the financial markets have actually been tooling along rather healthily for many months, if not well over a year. And yes, there are areas where it could be a little bit better. But for the most part, you've seen the stock market responding. You've seen the bond market responding. Companies have been able to raise capital and to borrow. So from the point of view of high finance, things are running along pretty smoothly, actually.
Yes, but one is obliged to point out, if you look at today's jobs numbers, Heidi, that those companies may be raising money and the bond market and the stock market might be fine. Nobody's doing a whole lot of hiring.
It's true. You have to look a little bit ahead. So generally, when companies are borrowing more, it's an indication that they are ready to hire because it means that they're really looking at expansion. And companies have been doing that. So that means that probably we're on the edge of a hiring, if not boom, at least healthier hiring.
If, though, Sudeep, corporations are getting ready and we're not getting satisfaction from Washington, is Washington's response to the recovery over? I mean, the president is trying to do the grow the economy thing.
The president came into office with 7.7% unemployment, and he'd be lucky if he had 8% unemployment in 22 months when people are voting for him. And so that's a big problem. But the focus now is on more of a corporate focus for the White House. They've brought in a new chief of staff who is an investment banker. Whoever thought something like that would happen? And that's really important because Bill Daley, the incoming chief of staff, was the commerce secretary, and that position is very heavily focused on trade and export promotion. And that's the last real hope the president has.
Yeah. So, Heidi, let me ask you the zeitgeist question, right? For all the press that's been about Bill Daley and today Gene Sperling coming in as head of the National Economic Council, does the actual economy in which we all live and work, do they care about any of that stuff?
I think that they do care about it, but there's a question of what you can do about it. Like, for instance, one of the things being discussed in Washington right now is whether we should take the power to help unemployment out of the hands of the Fed, or rather the requirement to help unemployment. And, you know, and Chairman Bernanke actually seems welcoming of that. It may just be that we have allocated the assignments of how to fix this economy incorrectly. All we're doing right now is going two steps forward, two steps back, and it doesn't really seem like there are benchmarks beyond the political ones that we're trying to reach.
Sudeep, here's a scary thought. Is it not actually two steps forward, two steps back? Is it two steps forward, three steps back?
It is possible that we're getting to that point. Right now, this is all the start of the 2012 election cycle, and that's why you're seeing some of the ridiculousness at an even higher level than you've seen before. But there are some important decisions that have to be made, and the White House is realizing that the political tide has shifted, and they're going to come out with a new budget in a couple weeks that addresses some of those concerns and hopefully prevents the political nonsense from really taking the front seat.
Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Heidi Moore in New York City. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Question of the week here on the broadcast has been, what now? What are we going to be debating, questioning, and covering as 2011 unfolds? Our commentary series wraps up today with something more personal, less public policy. Commentator and Google executive Marissa Mayer on technology.
I have a confession to make. I am a geek. Now, granted, geek isn't a word you often hear referring to women. But I am a geek. Not only am I a computer scientist by training, but I love to code. On Linux, on web servers, in C++, JavaScript, and MySQL. Outside of work, I cook using spreadsheets. I often think about how organizing one's closet is really just a data problem. Did I wear that skirt last week or the week before? Where is the blouse that goes with that? Is it at the cleaner or tailor? Couldn't we just solve this already with some RFID tags, a scanner in the ceiling, and the tiniest bit of C++? And like most geeks, I'm actually painfully shy and introverted. All of which has to make you wonder, how did a computer scientist, and such a geek to boot, end up reading this piece on the radio? The answer? The internet. The internet is changing almost everything. It's changing how we communicate, how we connect with each other. It enables opportunity. It even, thanks to Google, helps people find stuff in a way they never could before. And in the world of technical women, it's enabling something quite extraordinary. It's helping geeks, like me, all over the world, find their voice, and find their passion. And passion, to me, is what being a geek is really about. And while passion is geek-enabling, passion is also gender-neutralizing. People often ask me, what's it like to be a woman at Google? And the question always kind of throws me, because I'm not a woman at Google. I'm a geek at Google, and it's absolutely positively great. In a world where there are too few technical women, the internet serves as a powerful point of inspiration and an amazing way to tap into human creativity and potential. So, empower the geeks you know. Encourage girls. Let them know it's okay to be a geek. Daydream about mechanical engineering and how it relates to fashion. Make something thought to be science fiction a reality. teach girls that finding your passion means that all the little details that get them excited should matter. And most of all, embrace your own inner geek.
Marissa Mayer is the Vice President of Consumer Products at Google. So, what now for you this year? Send us your thoughts, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, why stealing bulldozers is just that easy.
No one sees them going because it's not unusual to see a machine driving down the road on a weekend.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 22 points today, nearly 0.2%, closed at 11,674. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%, finished at 2703. The S&P 500 fell 2 points. That's a 0.1%, ended things at 1271. For the week gone by, the Dow was up 0.8%. The S&P 500 rose 1.1%. That is the sixth straight week of gains for the Dow and the S&P, if you're keeping track. The NASDAQ charged up 1.9% this week. Wells Fargo took off 2%. U.S. Bank Corp lost 0.75%. Bank of America, the nation's biggest mortgage lender, fell 1.33%. We'll tell you why, but you have to stick around for the rest of the broadcast. J.P. Morgan Chase dropped nearly 2%. Goldman Sachs upgraded 2 energy companies. Diamond Offshore Drilling climbed nearly 5%. Baker Hughes pumped up 3.25% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.33%. Repeating infinitely, I suppose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, President Obama meets with French President Nicolas Sarkozy. In Detroit, the North American International Auto Show opens to the press. The public show starts next weekend. Experiencing post-holiday doldrums? Need something to celebrate? It's National Clean Off Your Desk Day, something we've all been looking forward to. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Unrest and violence are two words that come to mind when a lot of people think of Sudan. But here's another one. Oil. Crude has turned Sudan into a major global supplier, which is part of why a referendum on independence for southern Sudan beginning this weekend is getting some attention. John Temin is the director of the Sudan program for the United States Institute of Peace. And when we spoke, I asked him first for a historical snapshot.
The North and South in Sudan have been at war with each other almost since independence in the 1950s. And that war has stopped and started until 2005, when a comprehensive peace agreement between the North and South ended the wars. And part of that comprehensive peace agreement was the provision that the South would have the right to vote on whether to remain part of a united Sudan or secede and become its own country.
What does the Sudanese economy run on right now?
Oil, primarily. The government in southern Sudan, there's a semi-autonomous government of southern Sudan, it gets about 98% of its revenue from oil. In the north, probably something like 60% or so comes from oil.
Geography here is important. The north has the hardware, the refineries, and the pipelines. The south has the actual oil, but the south is landlocked.
That's correct. About 75% or so of the oil is found in the south, But all the refineries are in the north, and the pipelines largely go through the north to the port at the Red Sea. And they realize that at least in the short term, they need to cooperate with the North in order to profit from it at all.
So what happens if over the next week, southern Sudan, as is widely expected, does vote for independence?
Currently, they split the profits from oil found in the south 50-50. Certainly, the South is looking to gain a larger part of those profits, and particularly if there were more finds. There are a lot of parts of the South that are currently unexplored, and there is speculation that there may be significant sums of new oil to be found as well.
This is not an election that affects just East Africa. I'm thinking now of the larger global oil market, and specifically the Chinese. They get a not insignificant portion of their oil from Sudan, don't they?
Absolutely. The Chinese get something like 5 to 7% of their oil imports from Sudan. They are heavily invested in the Sudanese oil industry, so this matters very much to them. Recently, they've given indications that they are willing to accept southern secession as long as they continue to have access to the oil in both north and south.
Yeah. You were there last month in advance of this referendum that's coming up this weekend. What's your sense of what's going to happen and whether or not it's going to be a peaceful election and then a follow-on?
I am cautiously optimistic that it will be peaceful. I think the North generally recognizes that the vote will be overwhelmingly for secession and that they need to accept that outcome. And in the South, there are very high expectations amongst the population about how their lives are going to improve and the tangible benefits in terms of schools and roads that they're going to see if they become independent. But it's up to the government of southern Sudan to deliver those things, and it's going to cost a lot of money.
John Temin is the director of the Sudan program at the United States Institute of Peace. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so get a load of this. A 1995 Caterpillar bulldozer is missing in Georgia. A 2006 Caterpillar backhoe gone from South Carolina. A 2010 Hitachi excavator in Quebec. Forget cars. Construction and farming equipment is being stolen at an alarming rate. Naturally, the places with the most machines are reporting the most thefts. Texas tops the list in the United States. Up north, the hottest province is Ontario, from where Marketplace's Sean Cole reports.
Hello, sir.
I'm going to guess that you're the man.
That's me.
I meet up with Tony DePeedy in Bradford, Ontario, about an hour north of Toronto. He co-owns a road construction company called North Rock Group.
And this is our project.
Right now, the company's widening a two-lane road into five lanes. There are guys in hard hats everywhere, lots of big yellow construction vehicles. And while nothing's been stolen yet from this job...
In general, have you had stuff stolen?
Oh, we have. We've had... Here's the loader right here, 624 John Deere loader. We were working in Barrie a few years ago. They stole that machine.
That very one?
That very one.
Luckily, someone found it parked just a few miles away. But last year, DePeedy lost a 310 John Deere backhoe. The police report says men wearing orange construction vests drove away with it, and it's still missing.
And it was there Saturday, came back Monday morning, it was gone. So they had hot wired, did whatever they had to do, started and just took off. No one sees them going because it's not unusual to see a machine driving down the road on a weekend.
That's the thing. Stealing a loader or a backhoe seems impossible, if not insane, which is exactly why it's neither. No one's expecting it. Statistics Canada says more than 1,100 of these machines were stolen nationwide last year, and less than a third were recovered. George Kleinsteiber puts the theft count at 3,300, with an even smaller recovery rate. Who is George Kleinsteiber?
This is the size of the ones that they're mainly stealing right now.
He's like a walking detective novel about heavy equipment theft. A retired cop who now consults with the Ontario Sewer and Water Main Construction Association. Right now, he's showing me a Volvo L11 EO wheel loader parked in an auction lot in Bolton, Ontario.
But you're looking here at just over $140,000.
Really?
Yep. And you can see how easy it is. I could hop in this now and be out the gate and gone.
Well, particularly as it's running.
Yeah, well, but I mean, if I had the Volvo key.
That's right. He said the Volvo key. With a lot of manufacturers, one key fits everything. Volvo does this, Caterpillar does this.
And you can walk into a Caterpillar dealer with no questions asked and buy a key for $9.95, and it would start any Caterpillar machine.
That seems extremely wrong-headed to me.
The owners of the equipment want it that way, because if a company has 400 machines, they don't want to have to be looking for 400 different keys.
Kleinsteiber says organized crime is behind a lot of the thefts. Sometimes they replace the VIN number with one from a different machine. Often the machines are fenced overseas in Eastern Europe or the Middle East. Last year, Kleinsteiber personally tracked down a stolen motor grader in Dubai after its owner saw it listed for auction there. The thieves probably shipped it there in a big metal container from the port of Montreal.
So we're entering the port area?
Where I meet Dominic McNeely with the Canada Border Services Agency. He shows me this big white truck with an L-shaped arm hanging off of it, a scanner.
It's worth $2.3 million, and it allows us to see what's inside a container without having to open it.
But McNeely says a million containers pass through this port every year. The agency only targets 3 or 4% of them for thorough inspection.
It does seem like a small number, but our mandate is to facilitate the free flow of goods and people across our borders. And one thing that is certain is that we cannot open every container that comes in or that leaves.
These containers, it's just like a cloak of nothingness.
Again, George Kleinsteiber.
The deep hole out in the galaxy that once it goes in there, it's gone. And for the owners, it's part of their family. Every one of these machines is like a family member. And they really get upset when they're stolen.
I asked Tony DePeedy of North Rock if this was true.
I wouldn't know if I'd go to the family part, but yeah, they're your bread and butter. They're a necessity. I need it.
DePeedy says he's put special markings on some of his machines, installed a secondary ignition on some. Still, he's pretty sure he'll get robbed again. It shouldn't happen in this open, well-trafficked area, he says. And so that's where it will happen. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an update on the mortgage paperwork mess that was much in the news before Thanksgiving. All the stories about robo-signers processing tens of thousands of mortgages in an impossibly short period of time. Part of the question in those cases was who actually held the mortgage on a house, the IOU, the actual note. And if a bank didn't know where its mortgage paperwork was after it had sold all the loans out as mortgage-backed securities, could it foreclose? Well, no, it can't. The state Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts said today that if it can't find the right papers, tough beans for the banks. No foreclosure, which helps explain at long last, if you were listening during the numbers, why bank stocks had such a rough day today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow dropped 22 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 down 2 points. That is 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Now more than ever, people are preaching the gospel of financial literacy. But is it falling on deaf ears?
Today, we have a banking industry that thrives on consumer failure. Its bottom line depends on persuading us to borrow more than we know we can afford.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.